I want to thank both Ellie as well as Rabbi Sittner for inviting me here tonight to speak tonight as well as to speak next week. Just by way of introduction, my name is Mordechai Torchiner. I am with a program called the Yeshiva University Tarmit Zion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov, which is a very long name for what is really a kind of a small program. There are four of us. We have more words than we have people. But the program actually has sort of multiple parts, which explains the long name. In part, we are a rabbinic training program for young rabbis, and part of my job is to train rabbis for the rabbinate. Before coming to Toronto 5 years ago, I was a synagogue rabbi for a dozen years, and supposedly that qualifies me to be involved in training. Don't know. Nonetheless, that's part of what I do, and then part of what we do is we're based at Yeshivat Or Chaim Boys High School in the Clinton Park area. We do some work with the students there, as well as from their girls' school counterpart called Ulpana. In addition to that, we work with university students, primarily from York, but also U of T, Ryerson, and a couple of other programs. And they study with our rabbinical students. And when that's not going on, part of my job is to spread the ideals of Yeshiva University, as well as an Israeli organization called Tarmit Zion, by teaching classes around the city. And that's sort of what I'm doing here tonight. And I say it's sort of what I'm doing here tonight because really when Ellie contacted me and asked me to speak about relationships, my first answer was, why me? And my second answer was, I am entirely unqualified. My third answer was, no. I didn't actually say these out loud, but they probably came across. Yeah. And that's because really what I'm usually called upon to discuss is sort of technical topics. So I speak a lot to doctors about medicine and Judaism, accountants and lawyers about the intersection of their fields with Judaism. I talk a lot about Israel, a lot about text, about the books of the prophets, and sort of, you know, areas where it's easier to point to something and say, yeah, that's it. That's, you know, that's what the message is, that's what the idea is, and that's what we're supposed to apply. And when you deal with relationships and you're talking about human beings, there's no such thing as that's it. There's no such thing as this is the way it ought to be, because we are varied. We have personalities that are divergent. We have relationships that are different. And to point to something and say, okay, this is authoritative truth, is awfully hard. And frankly, if you're able to point to something and say this is authoritative truth, odds are you're not telling anybody anything they didn't know. So really, you know, what have you accomplished? So I kept refusing, sort of, if you read the Torah portion last week, and Ellie, don't get a swelled head out of this, but Moses speaks to God, and God says, I want you to do this, and Moses keeps refusing. So I'm not Moses, and Ellie isn't God, but that was me, declining. But Ellie was so enthusiastic. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that maybe I might have something to say with your help this evening about the topic that we're going to discuss, that I thought, okay, let me go for it. And I'm really grateful that, you know, over the 15 minutes or so before we got started, people introduced themselves, and that helped me feel more comfortable about this. And what I'd like us to do is work together to reach some, you know, insight into the idea of exclusivity in a relationship. Exclusivity. Monogamy is another word that people use for it, but I prefer exclusivity. It reminds me of a friend who had some trouble finding somebody to go out with. You know, all the girls he would go out with weren't interested. And he used to tell me he wished that he would be the last man on earth someday, because then he could find out, you know, if they were telling the truth. I'm waiting. I'm glad that people laughed eventually. But I suppose being the last man on earth would be one way to get exclusivity in your relationships. But I want to talk about a more normal kind of exclusivity, the kind which I believe we're supposed to value in a relationship. When I say the word exclusivity, when I talk about a relationship being exclusive, what does that mean? What comes to mind? Only one other, yeah. So usually, when you talk about a relationship being exclusive, the image is, at least in my mind, and, you know, correct me. But the image is sort of, okay, so there's supposed to be two people in a relationship with each other, and there's nobody else. It's not an open marriage. It's not an open relationship. It's just the two of them, and they're living together, and it's and that's the sum of the relationship. But I want to talk about an exclusivity that I feel is deeper than that. And what I'm thinking is emotional exclusivity. The idea that the two of them, this couple, feel like they are in their own emotional world together. That what they share is something that only they will have. Even though they may have siblings with whom they're very close, and they may have parents with whom they're very close, and they may have children with whom they're very close, and they may have friends with whom they're very close. Nonetheless, the bond between them emotionally is unique, and we'll talk about ways in which it can be unique, but it's something that is really just for them. It's their world. Follow? It's a little bit unfair for me to propose that and then ask, so do you think this is a good idea? Because I proposed it here, but I'm actually quite open to disagreement. Is this something that should be a goal for a marriage? You can say yes also. Agreeing is also allowed. The idea that you're inhabiting a world together, yes?
I mean, to me it just seems like the term is still a little bit broad, a little bit vague to me.
Yeah. Right. So I think we do need to be more specific in order to really discuss this in detail. But for now, let me say that in addition to saying that it's something that is a special bond that they share that they don't share with other people, I don't want to give away the end at the beginning. That would be bad. But what I'm talking about is the idea. Well, let me actually state it this way. Early on in my marriage, I got married in 1997. So early on, I was the rabbi of a synagogue part time at that point, and Rabbi Sittner will be able to confirm for you that part time rabbinate means full time job, part time salary. So I was at the time a part time rabbi of a synagogue, small, 70 families, and in addition to that, to make up for the part time salary part of it. I taught computers at a high school because I studied computers at NYU. And in addition to that, I was working on transcription of audio recordings of classes given by Rabbi Soloveitchik, who you may have heard of. I was doing, I think five different jobs at the time. And my wife was in law school. She was finishing up law school. We lived in Rhode Island, for any of you who are familiar with New England at all. We lived in Rhode Island. And she was in law school in Boston. So she's, commuting and going to law school and doing law school things. And I am running around doing teaching and rabbiing and the various different jobs that I'm maintaining at that point. And because of that, we start to develop entirely different lives, right? Where my life is the rabbi thing, and her life is the law school thing. Our social circles are different. And at a certain point, we both look up and realize, it's sort of, we're running the risk of becoming like roommates, right? Like we're sharing an apartment, but we're doing entirely different things. That's the opposite of the emotional exclusivity that I'm looking for. That's sort of the anti, in which there's nothing shared. There's space shared, but that's it. But the idea of emotional exclusivity is that we are sharing our lives, our thoughts, our ideas with each other, and I'm going to talk more about how that works, and not sharing those with others. Now, to my mind, I do believe that it's a good thing, but I also think that it's rather challenging, right? What would be the challenges to achieving something like that today? In our world, realistically. Yes? Yeah, we have our phones, which accompany us everywhere. And which are insistent. Absolutely. We have you know, phones, technology in general that's drawing our attention. What else?
Sort of behind the phone, even.
Yeah.
But as you're talking about the exclusivity of thoughts and feelings and things that you share, you would be curtailing your relationships with your friends and with coworkers and the others. So that's an interest that I thought was part of relationships you're having with a friend is a unique thing, too, or with a coworker. And yes, there are parameters of it, but they all are going to intersect. It's not an exclusive.
Right. That's a really important point. Is I'm presenting this as an ideal, but truth to tell, modern psychology may not agree with me. Because we do live in a world which values, first of all, which values independence. And the idea that I'm not dependent on somebody else, and I shouldn't feel like I'm tied specifically to them to the point where it would be considered unhealthy. And because I am supposed to flesh out my identity and my relationships and not cut people off, it may not be good for me to be exclusive in this sense. That's another challenge. At what point does it start to be unhealthy? Another issue is the accessibility of other people. Right. I'm not going to ask how many people have heard, but I've certainly heard stories of guys who have found old girlfriends online, because now you can, through Facebook and everything else, you're able to meet people who were from your life before. We live in a society that does accept, to a certain extent, that kind of a reconnection and all of the challenges that it can bring with it. So you bring in somebody who you knew before, who you had old jokes with, who you had old interactions with, and things that'll resonate that don't necessarily involve the person you're with now. There are other draws on our emotional investment. Work, community, entertainment, all sorts of different things draw us into other relationships and lessen the exclusivity. So what I want to talk about is perhaps exclusivity as a goal. What is healthy? What isn't healthy? And again, I would like to involve everybody with this. It's a little bit hard for me to see if you raise your hand at different times because the room is dark. Don't change the lighting because I think it's perfect. But if you see that I'm not if I'm not responding, hey, you is just fine. So, sort of the first problem that I had when I set out to talk about exclusivity, and you can see the first two sources, the two sources that I brought there on the sheet, were just meant to show you sources in which they talk about the dangers of non-exclusivity in relationships. The first one talking about the phenomenon of the online affair, which robs the primary relationship of energy, because now your emotional investment is elsewhere. And then the second, from this writer, John Gottman, he talks about 12 ways to betray your partner other than sexual infidelity. And number two is betrayal of emotional exclusivity, flirtation, secret emotional attachments. But the first challenge that you get to when you want to talk about Judaism and exclusivity is the problem of polygamy. It's all well and good for Georgina to stand here and talk about this beautiful image of a couple who are in sync with each other and they only connect to each other. And in the meantime, the biblical text is filled with polygamy. There is no prohibition found biblically against a man having more than one wife. So what are you talking about? This could be a really brief conversation this evening. So in truth, the Torah's presentation of polygamy is perhaps the best argument for exclusivity. First of all, just as a point of information, why does biblical text permit polygamy? Why doesn't it prohibit it? What's the rationale? It's a logical rationale. It's not something up in the clouds. Yeah?
To have children.
Be fruitful and multiply, precisely. The very first thing God tells his creations that he wants is for them to multiply and to fill the earth. And frankly, the best way you can do that is polygamy. Because this way, your male, who is the fertilizer, for lack of a better term, is not tied up, and multiple women can be pregnant from him at the same time, as opposed to the opposite end, polyandry, where it's multiple males with one wife, and as long as she's pregnant or nursing, then there will be no further children. So, from a practical perspective, polygamy maximizes procreation. So the biblical text doesn't prohibit it. It becomes prohibited by Rabbeinu Gershom a little more than 1,000 years ago, a great rabbi in Germany whose words were accepted by Ashkenazic communities and spread into many of the Sephardic communities as well, so that European Jewry, some of North African Jewry, accepts it. And at that point, polygamy basically stops. There are some exceptions. But when I say that the biblical description of polygamy is the best argument for exclusivity, what am I talking about? Yes, Ellie.
But there were a lot of problems with it. Like, when you hear the stories, in the biblical stories, there's so much jealousy and so many things that come up.
Yeah. There is not a single case of happy polygamy in biblical texts. There are an awful lot of cases of polygamy, and there is not a single one that ends well. The text is trying to tell you something. The very first case we find involves a gentleman by the name of Lemech. People don't really know about Lemech, because his story is sandwiched between creation and Adam and Eve and Cain killing Abel and then the flood. So, you know, you have these other things to talk about. Who's going to talk about Lemech and his two wives? And the answer is no one. But when you read about it, when you read the text, you find out that Lemech has two wives. One wife's name is Ada. The other wife's name is Tzila. Ada is a word meaning pregnant. Tzila is a word that we associate with something happy, potentially something decorated. There's some question as to the etymology of the name. But if you take a look on your sheet at the third source, you find a commentary from the classic commentator Rashi, writing in the 11th century, but he's quoting earlier ideas, who explains Lemech's situation. He has these two wives. And I brought the Hebrew as well as the English. Take your pick. Kach haya darkan shel dor hamabul. This was the way of the generation of the flood. Achas lepiria verivia v'achas v'achas letashmish. One wife would be for procreation and the other wife for sexual relations. That was the way that apparently was common in those days. And the idea was, as Rashi continues to explain, that the one who was not supposed to have children would take some kind of contraceptive potion, and she would be in makeup and jewelry, and she would eat whatever she wanted to eat, and then the other one would be in mourning. Can't imagine that this, you know, was really popular among the women. And the truth of the matter is that as you read the text there, as it plays out, his wife staged a rebellion against him. Also interestingly there, both wives have kids. Apparently someone didn't take the potion at some point. But the point is that you have this description here of this abusive objectification where he's taking one wife and saying, well, you're going to be for this, and one wife is going to be for that, which is so repulsive and so repugnant in terms of what we value. And it's and it leads to, in fact, the word rebellion, I suppose, is the right word, a mutiny that they have against him. They don't like this. You move further in the Torah and you find Abraham married to Sarah, right? And then there is another woman, Hagar. And Abraham and Sarah are not able to have children. And then Sarah says, well, take Hagar and make her your wife. And Abraham refuses, and Sarah insists. And not only that, she says Hagar should not be a concubine, but Hagar should actually be a full wife. I brought you a comment from Nachmanides, writing in the 13th century, in source number 4. He highlights the fact that in the text, Sarah says that she wants Hagar to be Abraham's full wife. And of course, what's the result of that relationship? Anybody know? Sarah gets her out of the house, right? Hagar becomes pregnant, starts to mock Sarah, and Sarah, well, she doesn't kick her out. Sarah makes things very difficult for her until she runs away. right? And then an angel comes to her and says, you should go back to the house. The whole story is terrible. And then she has a son, Yishmael, and Yishmael gets evicted from the house as a teenager. It's a mess. And then we move further in our history, and we have Jacob, Rachel, and Leah, right? That, and plus Bilhah and Zilpah, who are brought into the marriage also. That one also is terrible. What's the result of that one? Well, the Jews end up going down to Egypt and becoming slaves, right? Because Rachel has, one of her kids is Joseph, right? You remember the story? And Joseph isn't in with the brothers who are the sons of Leah. They stay in different areas, and then there's jealousy that develops, and ultimately they sell Joseph down to Egypt. It's all a product of that rift. We move into the prophets, and we find a gentleman by the name of Elkanah, who has a wife, Hannah, and another wife, Peninnah. And Peninnah can't have kids, and Hannah has a whole host of Hannah can't have kids, Peninnah has a whole host of kids, and Peninnah actually mocks her and upsets her. I brought it in source number 6, the verse from the prophets about it. Hannah is miserable. And so on. I can bring you more cases, but I think this makes the case pretty clearly that polygamy is described biblically as a disaster. So that by the time you reach Talmudic times, none of the sages of the Talmud maintain a permanent polygamous home. None of them do that. As a matter of fact, the word in Hebrew for a co-wife is a sarah. Sarah, like saros, if you've heard the term saros. Right? That's exactly what it means. It's trouble. It's pain, it's trouble, it's difficulty. But beyond this, beyond the fact that polygamy is not a recommended model, we also find a more positive statement about exclusivity coming from the relationship between the human being and God. If you take a look at source number 9, the Hebrew is at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the second side. Right, Moses Maimonides, whose 810th yahrzeit was this past Sunday, actually. So that gives you a sense of when he lived, 811 years ago. So he's talking here about love of God. And he asks, what sort of love is appropriate when we talk about loving God? The Torah says, you shall love God. What does that mean? So he says, to love God, as I translated it here, greatly, excessively, powerfully. In Hebrew, Ava Gedola Yesera Aza Meod, to the point that his soul is tied to love of God. And he is perpetually lost in it, like an ill person who is ill from love, whose mind is never free of that woman. And he is particularly perpetually lost in it, whether sitting or rising or eating or drinking. Beyond this should be the love of God, as God instructed us to love him with all of your heart and with all of your soul. It's a vivid description. And it's a description we find quite a bit within the words of Tanakh, of the prophets, where they talk about loving God, and they use the love of a husband and wife as the metaphor for it. Commentators suggest that not only, this isn't a one-directional thing, where you say, well, because I'm supposed to, where we say that I should learn about loving God from loving a human being, but I'm also supposed to learn about loving a human being from the relationship that is expected of me with God. If you take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Tzvi Sobolovsky of Yeshiva University writes succinctly, following the Rambam, Rambam is Maimonides, following the Rambam's comparison between these two loves, we can learn from analyzing what he calls Avas Hashem, love of God, what a Torah perspective is regarding the proper love between husband and wife. In other words, what is expected of me with God should also be expected of me with my spouse. That's what's being suggested. So, what characterizes the relationship with God? What are the elements of my relationship with God that I'm supposed to now carry over to my relationship with my spouse? What exactly are we recommending? Well, three elements are the ones that I want to bring tonight, and hopefully we'll flesh out what we're talking about when we talk about exclusivity. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 11, this is a verse which I sent it to Ellie. I sent Ellie the sheets to copy, and then afterwards I thought better of my translation. But you have the translation that you have in front of you. And Hashem he'emarta hayom. I translate it here as, you have spoken for God today. This is a verse from Deuteronomy. To be your God, to walk in His ways, to guard His statutes and commandments and laws, and to listen to His voice. And God has spoken for you today, to be for Him a special nation, as He has told you, and to guard all of His commandments. You have spoken for God, and God has spoken for you. But the truth of the matter is that that's not a great translation. And this is what I want to now correct here. Do we have Hebrew speakers at all? No, so I can say whatever I want with the translation. Okay. The Hebrew doesn't say, Amarta, you have said, or you have spoken. It says, He'emarta. And it is legitimate, and this is the view of several commentators on the biblical text. It is legitimate to say of this, He'emarta means you caused somebody else to say. The verb in Hebrew for speech is amar. You spoke would be amarta. You made someone else speak. He'emarta. That would be the way to do this translation. And so, the way I think we should translate this source in number 11 is, you have caused God to speak today, saying that He will be your God. And that God has caused you to speak today, to say that you will be His special nation. There is something that you have done that has made God say, I want you to be mine. And there is something that God has done that has made you say, you want to be His. There is something that one person in a relationship can do to make the other in the relationship say, yes, this is the person for me. Yes, this is a relationship that I want to be in. That's one piece of this. Making the other person feel special, making the other person feel that they want to commit to you. Now, how do you do it? What do you say to somebody else to make them feel like they want to commit to you? So look at the verse. The verse says, you committed to walk in God's ways. You committed to pay attention to God, and therefore God says, I want to pay attention back to you. It's reciprocal. You cause God to say, I love you, when you act in a way that expresses love to God. And vice versa. That's the way God gets you to commit to a relationship as well. And that's one piece of this. Fairly straightforward, probably. But there's a second piece. And the second piece takes us into a tragic story in Jewish history. The Jews arrive at Mount Sinai after getting out of Egypt. Moses goes up the mountain, has a conversation with God, comes back down, and the Jews hear the Ten Commandments, right? We're familiar so far? Right? Okay, I didn't go see the Christian Bale movie, but I remember it. They comes back down from the mountain, and there the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, and then he goes back up the mountain. He disappears. Day after day after day. 40 days go by. He's still on top of the mountain. The people are wondering, he didn't take food with him. How long could he possibly have survived? And they decide, we need some new intermediary between ourselves and God, and they create a calf. Why a calf? Why then? All good questions for another time. But they create a calf. God tells Moses up on the mountain, you've got a problem. Your nation has sinned. And he specifically says, your nation has sinned. The relationship is severed. Sends him back down. Moses punishes the group that's most closely involved with the calf. And then he turns to God and he says, God, please give us another chance. And that's what I'm looking at in source number 12. God says to Moses, okay, fine. They can keep on going. They can go to my land. But I'm not going to be with them. I'll send an angel and the angel will lead them. And look what Moses says to God. He says, kind of boldly, in source 12, if your presence doesn't go with us, don't bring us up from here. I'd rather we stayed in the wilderness if you're not going to be with us. And he said, look, how would it be known that I have found favor in your eyes, I and your nation, if not when you would travel with us? And we will be set apart, me and your nation, from every nation on the face of the earth. Moses says to God, we need to feel unique. We need to feel that we have a connection with you that no one else has. If you're not going to be with us, then, frankly, we're not unique anymore. We're just like everybody else. And that's not acceptable. We need to feel unique. And on that claim that Moses makes in source number 13, the sages of the Talmud a couple of thousand years ago commented, I'm not going to read the entire text here, but you can see it there in number 13. Moses requests of God that God be manifest among us, and he requests that God be manifest only among us. He says, God, I want Jews to be prophets. I want Jews to be able to get special communications from you. And I want it to be only us. I don't want you to speak to other people the way you speak to us. Now, that opens up a whole discussion about God's relationship with Jews and with non-Jews, and that's unfortunately beyond the scope of what we're going to be able to discuss tonight. But what I want to get at is the request that he makes. He wants it to be exclusive in the sense that he doesn't want God to tell people, to tell other people the things that he tells us. He wants there to be a communication that is just to us. Don't tell everybody what you're thinking. How many people here have a blog? I don't want to ask that because that's rude. But I shouldn't make people raise their hands and admit it. But I will tell you that I have a blog. I've had a blog since, 2006. And my first one was anonymous. They went by the name Rabbi Without a Cause. And it was divulging secrets of the rabbinate. And then eventually I said, you know what? People are catching on. And so I scrapped that one. And it's hidden. And no one will ever find it again, I think. And then I started a different one, The Rebbitzin's Husband, where that's really under my name. And then when I left the synagogue rabbinate, I actually thought about changing the name to the ex-Rebbitzin's husband, but I thought people would misunderstand. So I didn't do that. But when you are writing for your blog audience, it's very tempting, speaking from personal experience, it's very tempting that the thoughts that are in your heart, your observations on life, are going to make it into there. And potentially before you've even told them to your spouse. And it's not just about blogging, because the same thing can happen with people you're friends with at work, or the same thing can happen with your fantasy football pool, or the same thing can happen with any number of other groups and involvements that a person has. What we're suggesting here is that there has to be some kind of privileged communication. Something that I tell my spouse and that I don't share with the world. That's a second piece of it. And then a third and last piece in this set of three. Take a look, please, at source number 14. This comes from a prophet named Micha. Micha prophesied towards the end of the first temple period. You're talking about 2500, 2600, maybe even a little earlier years ago. He said, I'm going to tell you what God wants of you. Three things, he says. What does God require of you but the following? One, to do justice. Two, to love kindness. And three, to walk privately with your God. The term in Hebrew, hatsnea lechet. The term in Hebrew is tsniut. Have people here heard the term tsniut before? At all familiar? Or tsniut, as it's called in the Yiddishization of it? The word is often used to refer to a style of dress, which is private. But it's actually a much broader concept. It's the idea that certain things are not for the world. Whether in terms of the way I dress, or the way I speak, or the way I walk, certain things are private. And what we're told here in number 14 is that God wants of us not only to do justice and not only to love kindness, but that our relationship with God should not be for public consumption. My religiosity should not be for the world to see. It's very interesting. In 2008, well, 2007, I suppose, it was the run-up to the first election of President Obama in the U.S. I was a rabbi of a synagogue in Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania being a swing state, that was a prime place for the candidates to go. And this was actually during the primaries when it was Obama versus Hillary Clinton. And they were, you know, having debates in various places. And there was a Christian college called Messiah College, which was, as it sounds, you know, fundamentalist, which invited them both for it wasn't quite a debate. It was a forum. And the way they did it was, first they had, it was Hillary first. First Hillary came up on stage, and she answered a bunch of questions with the moderator, and then afterwards, candidate Barack Obama came up and he answered basically the same set of questions. The questions were all about religion, and because I was the rabbi of a synagogue in the swing state, I was invited to come to this, and I'm sitting there, I got a front row seat. I can watch myself on YouTube anytime I want from, you know, way back when. And I was so uncomfortable. It felt like the Inquisition in white leather chairs is what I think I wrote at the time about this. It was so uncomfortable because you're putting up two people who really have a right to privacy of their religion and asking them questions which ranged from sort of the banal to who is your favorite biblical character? So, you know, Hillary said Queen Esther, which was nice. Oddly, Obama didn't get asked that question. I don't know why that one didn't go to him, because I would have remembered what he said. But, the sort of low-level questions. Then you had, so do you believe that God created the world in 6 days? Which I felt like, why did they have to answer that on camera? Or in front of, a couple of thousand people they don't know? So that question was actually only put to Barack Obama, and he ducked it rather well. But the... He literally ducked it. He talked about what he talks to his children about religion, and then he veered off into the questions that they ask, and he managed to get far enough away on a tangent that they couldn't bring him back. It was an incredible. You can watch it on YouTube. If you search for Messiah College, Obama Clinton, you'll see the recordings. They're there, and you can wave to me. But the reason I bring it is because we have this value of tzniut. We have this value of privacy that Micha is trying to say here regarding your relationship with God. That it's not for everybody to analyze, and certainly for everybody to bear witness to. But I want to apply it also in terms of the human relationship now, taking this back to the spouses. And that, my relationship with my spouse isn't, according to this logic, isn't for the world to see. It's meant to be private. That doesn't mean they shouldn't know it's there. They should know that it's there. But the details aren't really for them. So those are the three manifestations of privacy that I'm looking at here as learned, now three manifestations of exclusivity that are learned from the model of the relationship with God. Number one is asking myself, am I letting my spouse know how special they are to me so that they will want to be exclusive with me? Am I telling them things that I don't tell other people? And is it private, so that other people don't get to see the manifestations of the relationship? Is this making exclusivity somewhat more clear? Is this something that we can buy into? Yes? No? I mean, I'm good with a no, as long as it comes with an explanation. Ellie?
Well, I have a question. Yeah. There are times in Judaism where they talk about, God is also part of that. So that's,
mm-hmm.
or that you you should be sometimes closer with your rebbe or your rabbi. Then, you know, so how does that work if it's supposed to be exclusive between a man and a wife? How does that figure if there's this triad in a certain amount?
Good. I want to come back to that. Remind me if I don't, but I have a whole section here where I want to, so I expect to address it. Before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit about why Judaism would care that my relationship should be exclusive. My relationship with my spouse should be exclusive. There are advantages to exclusivity. What are the benefits of having an exclusive relationship? What are the advantages of it? I don't mean it a very, like, okay, good, it's a better relationship. But practically, what are the advantages?
There's a security to it.
Right. On one level, there is security to it. I brought you on the sheet, actually, in Source 15 from Jeffrey Jensen Arnett. He says, each partner gains from marriage a sense of security, a promise that his or her partner is serious about staying together for the long run. This may seem ironic, given that nearly half of marriages in the United States end in divorce. But almost no one who enters marriage expects to end up among the half who divorce. In the national, he's talking about a study done by Clark University. So in this national Clark poll, 86% of 18 to 29-year-olds agreed that, quote, I expect to have a marriage that lasts a lifetime. So there's the sense of security that comes from this. That's definitely a part of it. He actually talks more about this and emphasizes as well that there's this sort of expectation of society that people will enter into the marriage thinking that it's permanent. Stronger than that, it enables a couple to achieve mutual goals together. If you take a look at source number 16 for writer Matthew Rose, this is from a work called Ethics with Barth, Karl Barth being a Christian writer. And he says, what makes marriage different from a particularly intense friendship? For Barth, the chief purpose of marriage is that one can learn the meaning of one's humanity with another person who is really a bodily other, not just another like oneself, but one who is different in ways constitutive of our humanity. This fellowship being indissoluble and all-embracing, divorce is not permitted except as an absolute last resort. Leaving aside his approach to divorce, because that's not, to me, the main thing here. His point is that when you form a relationship with somebody, an exclusive relationship, it's an opportunity to be vulnerable. And it's an opportunity to learn about our humanity with somebody else. I brought you also in source number 17 a different perspective, a business perspective. He writes, this is Bobby, I'm not sure how he pronounces his name, I assume Lied. First, we must understand what makes marriage different from alignment. He's talking about, as you see the title, the marriage of business and IT. With a marriage, two entities put aside their separate agendas to work for the ultimate good of the new single entity. Although each entity still has individual needs to be met, they do so with knowledge and understanding of the other side. These newly joined entities work toward the common good of the organization, resolving their disagreements together. So another benefit here is that you each put aside your separate agendas in favor of the good of the new one entity. But I think there's more to it, beyond the practical benefits. An exclusive relationship with a commitment from each side, with special communication operating out of the public eye, isn't just stronger than a non-exclusive relationship. It's actually a different animal. It's different in its essence from a relationship that is open. It creates a universe of two inhabitants who just focus on each other. If I'm in a relationship that is open, right? Imagine for a second that you use arrows to draw it, right? So you have one person here, and you have one person here, and the relationship with each other, so they just have an arrow going from one to the other and from the other back, and that's it, and everything is shared that way. But if the person who is here in the relationship also has another relationship over there, then some things are going that way, and not to this person. and something's going this way and to whatever else, whatever other arrows you want to draw. And ditto in reverse for the person who's standing here, right? Some of this person's arrows are going off in other directions as well. So their creative thoughts, their observations on life, their fears are going to be shared in other ways. It's fundamentally different. It's not just that it is lesser. It is different. The two types of relationships are actually different, and what it reminds me of is actually something that we do under the chuppah. There are seven blessings that are recited under the chuppah. They're called Sheva Brachot. One of the major themes of the seven blessings is that God created Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. It is stated explicitly in some of the blessings, in others it's just an undercurrent that's subtly there. But the idea of Adam and Eve in Eden, which would be the original exclusive relationship. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 18, you may find the verse that started all of this. This is after God creates Adam and Eve. You know, there are two biblical accounts of the creation of Adam and Eve, right? In the first account, as it's presented in chapter 1 of Genesis, God creates them simultaneously. In the second chapter, he creates Adam, and then puts Adam to sleep, and separates Eve from Adam. Right? You've noticed this? Why are there two different accounts? First one didn't work. But either he did or he didn't, right? Either he created them simultaneously or he didn't create them simultaneously. So if I was a Bible critic, my answer would be because they're two different stories that were merged together at some point. But Nachmanides, writing in the 13th century, basing himself on writing in the Talmud that goes back more than 2,000 years, suggested that there are two different aspects of the creation. When they are first created in chapter 1, it's talking about creation of the soul, which fits the language that's used there. The soul is one soul. Man and woman are created simultaneously, but they're in one body. Second chapter describes creation of the physical form, separation of Adam and Eve into separate bodies. Now, if they were in one body, why just split them? Why not leave them that way? It would make the exclusivity thing much easier. So take a look at source number 18, where God gives his rationale. He says, Al-Kain, therefore, Yazav ish es aviv es imo v'davak b'ishto, a man will leave his father and mother and cling to his wife. V'ayul basarachad, they will be one flesh. That is the original verse about marriage found biblically, and it is exclusivity. The man and the woman cling to each other, they become one, there's nobody else involved. That also may be why God insists on making Eve's body from Adam's body instead of starting from scratch and creating something new. Right? God does not seem to be into conservation at that point, such that, you know, he's recycling. The idea seems to be that he wants to show they are, in fact, one unit. And so what we're getting here, what I hope we're getting here, and I hope I'm not off base, I think I'm not off base, but at this point, I've had half the beer, and I don't drink much. What I understand from this is the idea of exclusivity playing out in these three ways that I mentioned before. Letting the other know that you are committed and that they are special to you, and therefore causing them to say, I want to be committed as well. Second, expressing to them things that we don't tell others. And third, making this relationship a private relationship. But now I come back to the point that Ellie raised before. There are limits to exclusivity. Exclusivity has limits in terms of the relationship with God. For example, and I brought you here, source number 19. That's actually an essay that I wrote after that, after the debate forum at Messiah College. I'm not going to read it aloud here. That you can look at it when you like. But what I was troubled by and what motivated me to write this essay, which was called Private Religion, Public Religion, and the Passover Seder, is the fact that religion isn't always supposed to be between me and God, and especially in Judaism. We have a concept called Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name, which is public. We have a concept of praying as a community, which is public. We have a concept of studying Torah in groups, which is public. And the point that I was really caught up with there in the essay is we educate children. How in the world are my children going to understand what religion means to me, what it means to my wife, if we aren't expressing it in front of them? There are limits to exclusivity. There are aspects which have to be public and which have to be shared. And the same thing is true in our human relationship. We open our intimate lines of communication to our children as well. We want our children to see the love that we have. We want children to be aware of it. It has to, if for no other reason than it has to be a model so that they can develop healthy relationships when they grow up. They need to have something to build on. So I think that I have to concede that exclusivity is not an absolute. And I'll go back to the point you made before. Exclusivity taken to an extreme isn't healthy. You know, Maimonides writes extensively in his work of law, actually, a work called Mishneh Torah. He writes about the need for moderation, building on Aristotelian ideas about the golden mean. You don't go too far to one extreme, too far to the other. And this is a case in which I do think there is such a thing as taking it too far. A person should not, as I understand it, a person should not become just a function of their spouse. There does have to be a broader existence. But you still have to come back to the techniques of keeping this relationship something special and something unique, which really doesn't resemble the other relationships. So what I've suggested is these three pieces, which are learned from the relationship with God. Just as you had the verse in Deuteronomy in source number 11, which we retranslated, which says, show that you are special to me. Show that I am special to you, and then I will also want to commit to this. Number two, make sure that the communication says that the person is special. You share only certain things. You share certain things with them alone. And third, keeping the relationship itself private, saying I don't want it to be for the world as a whole. Now, this ended up being much more of a monologue than I had intended, and I apologize. But now I really can, because I finished what I had to say and even all the sources on the sheet. So now I really can, stop talking and ask you, does this make sense? Throw darts at it. Does this work? Yes.
I like what you have to say, but when you talk about the polygamy aspect in Judaism, where it was like a disaster, but how come? And I agree with that. I agree with what you're saying. But I'm wondering, why does the Rebbeim make it an issue of finance, other than this fact that there's just some sort of a conflict and exclusivity?
What do you mean, an issue of finance?
So basically, it wasn't the decree for the banning of polygamy because you couldn't support a woman's wife?
I don't think that was. What I'm remembering, which fits with what you're saying, is earlier. The biblical text itself says, it's in Exodus chapter 21, somewhere between 21 and 22, says that in the event that a man wishes to marry more than one wife, he has to make sure that he doesn't minimize three things that he provides for her. And it's Hebrew she'er, ksud, and onah, which is food, clothing, and then onah is sexual relations. So he has to make sure that he's not going to reduce his involvement with one by bringing in somebody else. That's what you find there, and that's the financial piece of it. But when Rabbi Gershom comes along in the 10th century and says, no more, it's a flat no more, whether you can afford it or not. He doesn't, as far as I know, he does not distinguish.
Okay, because what I've heard from many different people was an issue that guys could have support more than one wife, and that's why they demand it.
I'll tell you this. You have my email address on the source sheet at the top of the first site. So if you can get one of the guys to present a source for it, I would be very interested, because that would certainly give me a whole different picture of what was going on. Thank you. Yeah.
All the examples you mentioned where it didn't work, it seemed to me that was something you would
listing. That was not at all intentional. Let's go back to the list. Well, we have Lamech, Ada, and Sila, where it's intentionally so. Yeah. We have Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar. Score another one. Rachel and Leah involves one who can't have children, although that wasn't the motivation for the marriage. The motivation for the marriage was he loved Rachel, and then Leah was substituted in. Chana and Penina also. Huh, how do you like that? That's really interesting. I wonder what to make of that. It's true, as he's pointing out, in so many of these cases, one is able to have children and one is not. I think it might be stretching it, but it would be interesting to use that as a support for the idea that polygamy was allowed in order to have multiple, in order to enable procreation. I have to think about that one, but thank you. I totally missed that. Sorry?
I always thought that was it.
Right, but the fact that all of the biblical examples of polygamy that we mentioned are all cases in which one of them could and one of them couldn't.
Yeah, but it was obvious right from when I was a kid that it was always there, and that was the reason.
That's really funny. Okay, I totally had not seen it. I would note, I did bring a case on the sheet, which I didn't discuss because only I felt like I was overdoing it on this point. But I also mentioned in my notes here, and one of the sources, the multiple wives of King Solomon, which is another case of dissatisfaction, in which it's actually the whole story with Solomon and his wives is fascinating because his mother, if you look at the end of the book of Proverbs, his mother gives him advice and says, this is what I think you should look for in a wife. And he spends his entire life searching and he never finds what his mother had laid out for him. If you're familiar with the poem Eshet Chayil, Woman of Valor, that's from his mother's advice to him at the end of Proverbs. His mother is saying, look for this. It doesn't quite work out. There's a longer story with that also for another time. Yes, Ellie.
I thought it was a really interesting question about the, able to have children and not able to have children, but it also seems to me, from a woman's perspective, laying out that you can have a full relationship whether you can have children or not have children. Mm-hmm. Even though those experiences are ripe with their different difficulties, they're also showing that you can, sometimes they have wives who do and sometimes they have wives who don't, but there are different relationships that still valid full marriages with
right.
Right.
That's a very important point. Thank you. While it's true that this initial statement from God is, multiply, bear fruit and fill the earth and so on. Nonetheless, Abraham and Sarah have a marriage for decades before, Isaac comes along. The marriage can be a beautiful, full marriage with all of the elements of this exclusivity, even without children being there. Well, thank you very much. Next week, our topic is love and justice. I don't have the full text in front of me, but I think it's on the flyer over by the door. The question of what do you do when things aren't quite where they should be? What do you do when one of them actually does something that's wrong? Now what do you do? How is that dealt with in a healthy marriage?